It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving. Today, while you shop or get creative with leftover cranberry sauce or whatever you're doing, we've got a cool Black Friday casserole of some of our recent favorites, starting with three from our October series of shows from WNYC's performance studio, The Green Space, in front of a live studio audience. First up, the intersection of sports and politics, and it's been a year for that, with New York Liberty stars Swin Cash and Tina Charles. Then Neil deGrasse Tyson explains the universe. And performance artist Marina Abramovic gives us a lesson in loud mindfulness and tells a joke. Later, a music critic's take on Bruce Springsteen's new memoir, What a Dog Knows Thanks to Its Nose. And for those participating in the Black Friday shopping, Consumer Reports fills us in on cashless shopping risks and rewards. Enjoy. My first guests are big stars in the world of sports, but they're here mostly not to talk about the art of passing, dribbling, and shooting, but to talk about the trend and the issue of athletes like Colin Kaepernick and now many others not standing for the national anthem before the games or doing other things to protest racial injustice in America. What you may not know is that Kaepernick wasn't the first major protest by professional athletes this year. In July, following the rapid succession of the shootings of Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, and the Dallas police officers, several different WNBA teams, including our own New York Liberty, began demonstrating support of the Black Lives Matter movement by wearing black warm-up outfits with phrases like hashtag Black Lives Matter and hashtag Dallas 5 printed on them. Here is Tanisha Wright, a guard for the Liberty, speaking to the press after a game in late July.
We really feel like there's still an issue here in America, and we want to be able to use our platforms. We want to be able to use our voices. We don't want to let anybody silence us in what we want to talk about. So you guys can ask away about anything that's happening in society. And it's unfortunate that the WNBA has fined us and not supported its players. So whatever you want to ask about that, feel free. But we'll only be taking questions about that today.
Tanisha Wright at a post-game press conference in July. And with me now are Swin Cash and Tina Charles, who played for Liberty this past season. And I will say this because Swin retired at the end of this past season. And we're both outspoken about their involvement with the protest actions. Hi, Swin and Tina. Welcome to the Green Space in WNYC.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So Black Lives Matter and the issues central to the movement have been in the news regularly over the past few years, obviously. What made you feel the need to finally speak out publicly this summer? Who wants to go first? Swin?
Well, I think we were at a time in our country where a lot of not just African-Americans, but I think everyone, humanity, watching people get killed day in and day out, and violence that was happening in the streets. And now with so much technology, you talked about the shootings that happened in Minneapolis and also in New Orleans. We just really got to a point where the players began to feel, what can we do? Like, this is an issue. It was one of those things where we started communicating with one another. Players were wondering, they were feeling, they were hurting. And as a veteran myself, getting phone calls in the middle of the night of hearing another player crying, asking why, like, why don't we matter in our country? Why isn't anything being done? How can you kill somebody? How can it be live streaming and it be acceptable? How can people not have any type of empathy for just human life in general? And I think it just got to a point as a group and as a league, women, we understand what it is to be oppressed at some point. I mean, if you're a woman at some point, whether it's corporate America, whether it's in college, different things, you've had to go through some issues. And I think that's why we identified even more, not only because we're African American, but because we are women and we have fathers and brothers and uncles, and we understand what injustices have been happening in our country. And we felt that we wanted to use our platform to really bring awareness to it.
And Tina, I think the Minnesota Lynx were the first WNBA team to wear Black Lives Matter warm-up outfits, though quickly spread to at least six of the WNBA's 12 teams, I see. Was there any organizing or coordination between players on the different teams? How did that go?
Yeah, for sure. You know, Swin, she's the VP of our union, And so, you know, there's a lot of information that was given to us as far as what was going to be done in the league and how could the New York Liberty participate. I think just us, you know, I'm born and raised in Queens, New York. I grew up watching New York Liberty. I saw it as not just a dream to play for this team, but also as opportunity to use our platform. So I think if any team in the league, if we wanted to take a stand, it would have to be New York Liberty. And, you know, when we saw what Minnesota Lynx did, we just wanted to be on board with what they were doing and how we can support, you know, our fellow sisters in the league.
Going back to Muhammad Ali's imprisonment as a result of protesting the Vietnam War, and Tommy Smith and John Carlos, Black Power Fists in the 1968 Olympics, the history of professional athletes and activism goes back far. Were you inspired by any other athlete protests in the past, or did this just come up spontaneously as a present thing that you both feel you felt you wanted to be a part of? Swin?
I'll answer that question, but I wanted to just add that the shirts that Minnesota Lynx wore first, they didn't just have Black Lives Matter on it. They had shirts that had also support for the police force, basically saying to pull everyone together. And they immediately got pushback from the chief of the union. The cops walked out during a game against the players not even being there to protect them. So it was even a deeper layer of issues that happened there. And I want to encourage most of you to go read even more about that. But in regards to my encouragement, I would say that we were just at a point in time where we had a decision to make, whether you stand up and use your platform or you worry about getting fined, you worry about losing sponsorship. And we don't make as much money as the men, but one of the things that I'm most proud of in my career, I've played 15 years in the WNBA, is that 144 women said, you know what, we can lose a lot right now. We can lose money, we can lose sponsorship, but we want to stand up and have our voices be heard. So yes, you can look back and pull from Muhammad Ali. You can look back and pull from you know, Dr. King. There's a number of people, but at the end of the day, if you look at the civil rights movement, beside every Dr. King, there's also a Dorothy Height. There's other women that were part of the movement, and it wasn't just African-American women. And so that, for us, if you look at WNBA, if you see us linked arms, it's just not the African-American women. That's the difference between our league and other protests, is that you see foreign players, you see Asian, you see white, you see Indian. These are all different people that came together for a purpose.
You want to pick up on that, Tina? Do you feel it really brings a lot of different kinds of people together to do this?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think especially with our league and just other organizations that we put on the front line, as far as the LGBT, as far as breast cancer awareness, you know, we have Green Week. So the fact that we were able to pick up on the Black Lives Matter movement, and it just wasn't African Americans that make up 70% of our league. You know, it was every race. So I think the unity that we showed of how important it is to raise awareness to what you believe in and stand up for what you believe in, it was just amazing to be a part of. And being that it's the 20th season in the WNBA, I think that was the major highlight of this season.
So you guys came before Colin Kaepernick. What did you think when you saw him doing it, and then all of a sudden it was a big national deal on all the networks?
I think he's exercising his constitutional right, and I think he's forcing dialogue that we need to have, conversations that's necessary to have. I think everyone has an opinion on how you should do something and how you should go about it, but he's actually taking a stand and doing it, and he's using his platform the same way that we did. And I think he was very articulate as far as his research as to why he's kneeling instead of sitting down. So what he's doing is really amazing, and he's sparking conversations that needs to happen, you know, in the same light. After our Olympic break, you know, we were still trying to figure out how can we keep the conversations going. As you guys saw a preview of what Tanisha Wright and the rest of us decided to do, to have a media blackout where we were only answering questions towards the Black Lives Matter movement because we wanted the conversations to keep going. So I think it's really great what Kaepernick is doing.
And that's a different kind of protest. He, as everybody now knows, didn't stand during the national anthem and then started kneeling during the national anthem. What you did was, in a post-game news conference, you wouldn't take questions about the game. You would only take questions about the issues related to your shirts, right?
Yeah, and I initially started and I made a comment on the game. And so I made a comment about the game, gave them their bite that they could use, and then everything else was, this is what we're going to talk about. And so I thought it was very powerful, and I thought the way we went about it was very professional. And we've said throughout this whole summer, and even as we move forward, it's really about, at the end of the day, we want to bring awareness and have conversations. Tina and I can sit here. What are some of my best friends, we don't agree on everything, but we can have respectful conversations and agree to disagree. Also, at the end of the day, like, my dad served this country 30 plus years. My dad seen more time overseas and defending our country than I saw him growing up at times. And so when people try to have these conversations and they throw back in my face or want to talk about, well, if you're protesting against the flag, you're protesting against our military. Well, let's talk about that. Let's have those conversations, because I think I'm pretty equipped to have those conversations with you.
Well, what do you make of the fact that people actually were surprised by that when it first came up with Kaepernick? That the pushback against it was, you're disrespecting our war dead. And that was not, I don't think, what he had in mind as even being relevant to it. I mean, you know, maybe because the national anthem is a song that takes place during a battle. But the country is not just our war dead. The country is everything about our country. And I think Kaepernick was surprised by the fact that what the critics focused on was war dead, when he was looking at the country as a whole, and it's got great things about it, but it's still got oppression going on that we need to deal with, and he wanted to take a stand. Are you surprised, as the daughter of a veteran, that's where the pushback seems to rest?
I wasn't surprised. And I say I wasn't surprised because I think it's like anything. It's like, if your mom or dad asks you a question and you don't want to answer it, you deflect to something else. And I think that's exactly what's happened. It's like, okay, we don't want to talk about what you want to talk about, but we're going to deflect and bring it to another issue. And so for me, as a kid whose brother served in the Army, cousin, grandfather, my dad, it's insulting because you cannot compare those two things. What our veterans and what our soldiers do and the sacrifices that they make, their families make to serve this country, it's so that I can make a decision whether I want to stand and be a part of this or if I want to say, no, we can do better as Americans. We can do better as a country. And so when he exercised that constitutional right, like Tina said, how can we sit here and try to figure out when it's okay to stand or when it's okay to kneel or do nothing? Like, who's dictating that? And I think that's the reason why conversations need to be had, intellectual conversations, and respectfully as well.
Let's take a question here in the green space. Who do we have? Hi.
Okay. I love your show. Thanks for having us all here. So some people are discussing whether it's even appropriate to be having the national anthem played at the beginning of the sporting events. I'm just wondering if you have a take on that.
I think it's appropriate. I don't have a problem with the national anthem being played. We both played in the Olympics. We both have gold medals, and so we've gone and been able to be the only team. Yeah.
Thank you.
And been able to be the only team that's standing there and hear your national anthem played when you know that everyone else in the gym hates your guts. And I also think that now you've seen, like, Megan Rapinoe, who is on the national team with soccer, and she's been getting to kneel. And I think she's eloquently said exactly why she's doing it, to support Kaepernick and what she feels are injustices. So I don't think that there's a problem with it at all.
Are there players who may not be inclined to display their politics in the athletic context kind of coming into conflict or dissension? Are there judgments going back and forth? Is it causing, you know, dissension between teammates? Is it on your team at all, Tina?
I think when it got to a point of the fines, I think that's when it became a little complex. You know, there's some players on your teams that financially can be in a space of taking a fine and standing up for what's right, and then there's those that's not, and then, you know, they have to think of what they want to stand for, and then it comes back to, well, if they really understand what's going on and thinking, like, you know, well, I'm not African American, so, you know, this isn't really my fight when it's about Americans and being united, you know. So
that's gonna drive you crazy, right? When somebody says it's your fight because I'm not.
Exactly. So you hear that as well. Yes. So for me, you know, there was a game where I still continued, in the light of fines, I still continue to wear my shirt inside out, mm-hmm. because I refused to be silent in the wake of the fines. You know, I thought, you know, to myself, you know, growing up in Queens, I think back in 99, you think of Amadou Diallo. You think of Sean Bell in 2006. You know, so for me, it was the bigger picture of if I didn't stand up for my right, me being from New York and me bearing witness to what happened back in the day when I was younger and going home to my parents and asking why this happened. Now technology is booming and we're able to see everything. So
how much were the fines?
$500.
Yeah.
It's $500.
Yeah, you're talking about a $500 fine.
And then leading
per
to suspensions
game.
As well.
Per game over a number of games, however long you did it. And then they rescinded the fines after a while, right?
Yes.
They did. That's what happens whenever you can stand together and you don't break off and go around. It's like anything. You want to change something, then you stand unified. And that's how a movement works. It's how a union works. Mm-hmm. And we were able to get it done. But I do want to comment and say that thank you, because that's how you get it done. I want to comment and say that even when we were having, you have to understand, we're in a locker room and people have different money issues and there's foreign players and there's everything that's happening.
Yeah.
It wasn't like an easy thing, this is what we're doing, and everybody fell in line. It was, let's talk about it, let's figure it out. And then it became a point where the players who've been in the league a little bit more said, you know what, I'll pay your fine, pay your fine, and we'll keep moving forward.
We'll keep
so that's how a team operated.
And for the record, That's what locker room talk is.
Yes. 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 Boom.
Boom. That's what locker room talk is. Oh.
Yeah, drop mic. I just dropped the mic and walked out.
Right, boom. And WNBA president Lisa Borders eventually tweeted, appreciate our players expressing themselves on matters important to them, rescinding imposed fines to show them even more support.
Mm-hmm.
So you can applaud for that. did that feel like too little too late? Did that feel like, oh, she's, condescending to us? Or was that like, okay, we got something done here?
No, for me, it was like, okay, now let's come to the table and what are we going to do moving forward? That was, I don't know how you felt, Tina, but that's how I felt.
No, I thought it was, I thought it was amazing. You know, the fact that you were able to see a result from what you stood up for, for what you worked hard for. Just like I saw in the civil rights movement, what I saw in movies, what I read about. So to be a part of something as moving as that, it was really special to me. And now we're trying to figure out, how can we engage with law enforcement and force conversations within communities and try to find a solution of how we could change the system.
Mm-hmm. My guest, if you're just joining us, Swin Cash and Tina Charles from the Liberty of the WNBA on their protest this summer and things that flowed from it in support of Black Lives Matter and relevant issues. And we can take some phone calls at 212-433-WNYC as we're here live in the green space today. We'll also go to our next audience member with a question, and we have somebody right over there. Hi.
We did this entire unit at school about whether you should stand or shouldn't stand for the national anthem. And do you think it's good that people are making a stand like this?
By the way, is school out today?
No.
This is part of the project, right? You're here for a project,
right? Do I need
to
report you to someone? No. I'm not going to put you on the spot. But sometimes we have one of the Brian Lehrer Show traditions has been that we have homeschool students call in to the show sometimes.
Awesome.
I mean, we don't solicit it, but it's something that's happened over the years is that some people's parents who are homeschooling them actually use the show as kind of a midday public affairsy thing on selected selected segments. So maybe that's the origin of that question. But anyway, what's the answer?
I would say, one, that's a great question. Two, I would say you live in the United States of America, so you have the right, whatever it may be, to stand, to kneel, to sit. It's your choice, and that's why we live here in the greatest country in the world. And so I think you have to read, understand what you stand for, and then make that decision. Okay? That's my opinion. Now, your mom may have a different opinion, But as you get older, my mom once said to me, even when I was growing up and I would go to church and I would go to church all the time, my mom would always tell me, at some point, you'll find a faith for yourself. And when you do, then you'll be able to make those decisions for yourself. So keep seeking understanding and keep seeking knowledge. So, and that's in all things, not just in the protest, whether you stand or if you kneel.
Let me ask the control room to pick out a call. I can't see the callers from the green space stage on my computer out here. So if there's a caller you guys want to pick out, we'll go to a caller. In the meantime, maybe I'll ask you a basketball question.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Will you answer basketball? I realized, considering the topic, I don't know if you'll answer basketball questions. From what I've read, the WNBA would lose money and likely go out of business if not carried by the NBA teams you're affiliated with, like the Liberty by the Knicks. Assuming that's actually true, why do you think the league is committed to the existence of the WNBA?
I think Swin should answer that. She's a VP.
Of the union,
of
the players' union.
So I'm going to let her handle that question.
Well, one, I think that I'll say this, the WNBA is the best league in the world, and players from all around the world want to come here and play for a reason. I will say that the business side, just like everyone else did when we had the recession that happened, the WNBA suffered as well. Of course, we get some support from the NBA. There are some teams that are profitable, but at the end of the day, please believe the WNBA being successful and being here is good business also for the NBA. I think when you support women, when you're inclusive and you understand that they also should have a platform, then that's good for your business. And as you see in corporate America, more people are starting to understand that we need to be at the table. So for the WNBA, we need to be here. We need to be present. And for young girls and young boys to look up and say, hey, I can be like the next Tina Charles. I can be the next Epiphany Prince and whoever else it may be. So for me, I think, yes, it should be.
For people who don't know the game, the, you know, professional women's basketball, can you promote the women's game? Like, I'm thinking as a tennis fan, there are different things sometimes that I appreciate about the women's game than the men's game. They're not exactly identical. What makes it fun and different from men's basketball? Is there any, would there be any answer to that?
I would have to say the skill.
Yeah.
You know,
what are you saying?
I would just say skill, period. You know, with men, you know, everything is athleticism, you know, jumping out of the gym, the dunks and everything. No, we have to practice our skill as far as how much we play as a team. You know, what's necessary for us to win is different than what's necessary for the NBA players, for the team in NBA to win. For us, it takes five to win, literally. And just knowing our offense, knowing our defense, the discipline we have to have, the patience you have to have, the development of the game, I would just have to say it's our skill.
Yeah, and it's amazing that, you know, everyone loves Golden State right now. They move the ball. They shoot the ball. I'm like, well, we've been doing that
for a number of years.
But okay. And it's like it's pure basketball, and it's fun and it's skills. And so I agree with Tina.
For sure.
But the criticism of Golden State is – you know, it's really about one guy's amazing shooting skill, and that other teams have such incredible teamwork. And some people root, you know, might have rooted for Cleveland over them for that reason, to take an NBA example. But do you think it takes more teamwork? Is that kind of part of what you're getting at in the women's game? Because the men's game is more about individual showboating
and more like one-on-one. Yeah, I mean, definitely throughout the league, you know, you have amazing players that are one-on-one players. You have your Angel McCautry, Elena Deladon, Skylar Diggins. You have the all likes of them. But I think for the elite teams down the road, when it comes down to it, the ones that made it are the ones that have discipline in their offense and in their defense.
Do you use the triangle offense like Phil Jackson tries to get the Knicks to do?
We use elements of the triangle. Yeah. We do. We have a player like Tina Charles that no one can check her on a low block. We want to get her to basketball, and we want to kind of move off of her. And I know I'm talking basketball terminology, so let me rewind that a little bit. Tina Charles, very dominant. We can throw the ball into her, and she can score, which is great for us. But whenever they come to double team her, I can move and get a shot very easily. So for us, basketball-wise, it's good to have dominant players, but it's also good to play together.
What else are you into sports-wise, Tina? You fan of other particular sports?
I love softball, actually. I know that was very left field. But I love softball. I love baseball.
Only if you're righty and pull the ball.
I love baseball. My mom was a season ticket holder of the Mets back in the days in the 80s. So I love to get out to Citi Field as much as I can. I know we just lost the wild card game, but we'll be back next year.
That's another one where, like, you know, women's soccer, pretty big. Women's tennis, pretty big. Do you think it's harder with basketball and baseball, the softball, you know, being the pro women's game, that and basketball for some reason to catch on?
No, I think when it comes to all those other sports that you just named, I think I love personally team sports. I grew up as an only child, so I loved being around others, learning from others. You know, how do they engage and have respect for others? Just the discipline that they have and their approach to the game. Individual sports wasn't really necessarily something for me, but everyone loves one-on-one dominance. And I think you see that in Serena Williams. You know, you see that in your Andy Murray, you know. So for me, I'm all about team sports.
Swin, in terms of, you know, it becoming big in the marketplace for a whole lot of fans.
I think that the issue that we've struggled with on the WNBA side is that everyone always wants to compare us to the men, and that's because basketball in the United States it's at the top. And so when a man's sport is at the top, it's very difficult for people to see it on the women's side and also respect it. So we have to fight with writers to talk about our players. We have so many great women that have so many stories, but if mass media is only looks one way and is not diverse and doesn't want to talk about our stories, then it's very difficult for people to follow. You're going to follow Swin Cash if you know about me, if you identify something with me. Oh, she likes fashion. I do too. You know what? I'm going to go see her play. She's really cool. I'm following her social media. That's why it's all about branding and marketing. And it's the struggle for us is really getting to the mainstream media to let them cover us the same way that they cover the men. You talked about individual sports. Of course, people can see the dominance in Serena. You talk about women's soccer. Our men's soccer team is not that good. So everybody's looking at the women's team. I love our men's soccer team, but I'm just saying. So every couple of years when it's a major global event, you follow the soccer team. I mean, does anybody in this room know that 6 gold medals in a row, that's the most the women's basketball team has done? No one else has touched that globally. But do you hear those stories? Do you hear those stories? It's like people, it's like, why are they dominating? Somebody needs to be close to them. Why? We're America. Don't we try to dominate everything? I mean, that's what we struggle with.
Kristen in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kristen.
Hey there. I just wanted to thank both Tina and Swin for standing up and the whole team for standing up, because I know it's not easy, especially on social media with pushback, and some people just don't understand the message, or they're willfully misunderstanding. But I also wanted to ask if they are actively encouraging other teams and leagues to join in the protest, and if so, how are they doing that, and what responses they've received from other teams and other team members?
So thank you very much for your comments. We really appreciate the support. I would say that once we got back from the Olympic break, Phoenix, Indiana, a couple of teams have already started in the communities as far as not only hosting town halls, but behind closed doors, bringing community leaders together and having conversations with some of the local leadership. That's already started. I've had conversations already with the NBA as they're kicking off their league. You'll see even more social engagement from the NBA side. So this is really kind of a WNBA, NBA family thing where we're coming together and trying to make sure we're using resources, not just protesting and talk about it, but also putting dollars into these communities to try to bridge the gap, because it's really needed. And the way that we can do that is everyone loves sports. So we're trying to really bring people together using sport as a way to start the conversations.
Tina, you back with the Liberty next year? You signed?
Yeah, I'm back. Right. I'm not going anywhere.
Feel good about that.
That's right, because she's one of the very best in the league. So, listeners, if you weren't aware of the WNBA before and Tina Charles before, now you've heard her. You have a sense of her as a human being. Maybe you'll tune in next summer and watch a little WNBA basketball. And Swin Cash, I'm going to, you know, at the risk of embarrassing you, tell everybody what one of the first things is you're going to do now that you've retired from basketball, which is that I see you're being honored by the National Civil Rights Museum with their Freedom Award,
yeah,
which recognizes
thank you
recognizes outstanding individuals who have contributed greatly to civil and human rights, and she'll be accepting the award alongside people like Teocal Carmen, the youngest ever winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, and Bryan Stevenson, who's been on this show, the high-profile lawyer, activist, and writer. Do you have any jitters about that?
Just a little bit. It's really an honor. Throughout my life, I always live by the creed, to whom much is given, much is required. And I've tried to live my life in a way to give back because of the platform that I have. And so I'm excited about it. And I'll be accepting the award, but not just only on my behalf, but for all the other women in the WNBA as well. I think this summer really went close to home for me. And so I want to make sure that I acknowledge them as well.
Swin Cash and Tina Charles, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the host of Star Talk on PBS, Neil deGrasse Tyson. And our audience in the green space, stay with us. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls.
By the mid-2030s, I believe we can send humans to orbit Mars and return them safely to Earth. And a landing on Mars will follow. And I expect to be around to see it.
That was President Obama in 2010. This week, maybe some of you saw it, he put that in writing in an op-ed column on CNN.com. So who's ready to go to Mars? I'm guessing, yeah? All right, from the green space to Mars. I'm guessing my next guest might sign up, Neil deGrasse Tyson, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History and host of the podcast and National Geographic Channel TV show Star Talk, which now has an accompanying book. If that's not enough, he's the co-author with fellow astrophysicists Michael Strauss and J. Richard Gott of a new book called Welcome to the Universe, an Astrophysical Tour. Welcome back to WNYC, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks. Thank you.
And welcome to the green space. So the first
This is where you hang out on Fridays at the green
space.
Yeah,
we just come out and hang out down here.
Chilling in the green
whoever
space.
Walks by, you know, come on in. The first chapter of the book, Star Talk, is What Do I Pack for Mars? So are you all set to go?
No. Well, so whoever is designing the ships to go to Mars, I want them to send their mother first, right? And if that's safe enough for their, like, closest family members, then I'll consider going. But, yeah, if you're going to send me to space, give me a destination. None of this, you know, driving around the block, boldly going where hundreds have gone before. You know, this low Earth orbit stuff. I mean, it's 50 years old that we've been doing that, and it's time to go somewhere. And by the way, there's plenty of reasons to do so. It's not just for science. You can do it for tourism. You could do it for business reasons, even. And that may be the ultimate driver of it all, to turn a space program into a space industry.
Yeah, because it is something that people may not have their minds around in terms of the reasons to go for a destination that's far away. I mean, low orbit may not be sexy, but my understanding is there's a lot of science that can be done because you're out of the Earth's atmosphere that's very applicable to life on Earth. And there are some people who criticize spending a lot of money when there's still so much poverty on Earth and other problems on Earth to go gallivanting around even the solar system.
Yeah, I have heard less of that lately than in the old days. It used to be we can put a man on the moon, but we can't solve the poverty problem. Well, interesting fact today, we can't put a man on the moon. you can't even invoke that, actually. But I think people do see space a little differently now, especially since we know that you find grandma's house with a GPS locating system on a smartphone that involves assets that many of them are ground-based, of course, but just the space. So your phone's access to that information is from towers, but the satellites are orbiting the Earth. So space as a frontier of discovery and of ways that life on Earth can improve. Just think about this. Suppose we're all in the cave. This 20,000 years ago, we're all in the cave, and someone is ill, and other people in the cave say, I want to go explore across the valley. Someone says, no, let's solve all our problems in the cave first. before anyone leaves the cave. That today you'd look at that as a stupid decision, because cures and food and water and all sources of ways to keep you alive exist outside of the cave. And so to say, no, we have these problems and we're going to solve them first, that's just short-sighted. A quick point about the clip that you played of President Obama.
Yes.
I was at that speech. He gave it at Kennedy Space Center in Florida, and it was... what concerned me about it is when Kennedy said, let's put a man on the moon, return him safely to Earth before the decade is out, most of that time would have been under his watch had he not been shot and had he gotten a second term, which is not unrealistic in the day. So he was prepared to invest political and financial capital to that goal. But now we live in a time where President Obama can say, oh, in the 2030s, we'll go to Mars, under a president to be named later on a budget line not yet established. And so I don't know what it means for a president to commit multiple elections in the future relative to what Kennedy did in the 60s.
Interesting. We have a clip from Star Talk to play. This is you with Whoopi Goldberg. And actually, before we do that, why don't you set this up a little bit? Because you describe Star Talk as being where science and pop culture collide. So you interview a mix of pop culture and science figures?
No. Well, occasionally there's a science figure, but if I interview a scientist, it's because they're into something else that directly affects pop culture. And so the goal of Star Talk is not to bring you science as the focus. It is, we have celebrities hewn from pop culture, people you've heard of, even if you're not even necessarily a follower of theirs. So Whoopi Goldberg is a great example. And in that interview, I'd like to think I've provided a geek safe space for the celebrity to share with me secrets they might have about, you know, have they memorized digits of pi and they can't tell their friends? Or, you know, do they have any secret fantasies about, is there some bit of curiosity within them that just needs to be fanned, some embers that we can ignite? And so with Whoopi Goldberg, we learn that she's totally into the superhero genre, and she shares her thoughts on this.
And in this clip, what she wants in a superhero.
I'm a woman of a certain age who's always grown up with Superman and Batman and Supergirl and all of the DC and Marvel universes. And there's nothing out there for us. Mm. For women of a certain age, I want to see, you know, somebody who saves the Earth who looks a little bit like me, whose behind is a little bit bigger, whose chest is on the floor. But when that bitch's superpowers kick in, ooh, she could slap a whole nation of people on the way to taking care of business. That's what I want.
I don't think...
So
I don't think Donald Trump's reading that comic book.
No, I know, but... So I don't know where else someone with the stature, the pop culture stature of Whoopi Goldberg would be able to share that kind of sentiment. And so, like I said, it's a safe space for that. But what we do is you come for the celebrity, but in fact, the whole conversation that unfolds is all about science. And it's a way to clad science onto the scaffold that is pop culture that we all bring to the table.
Superheroes and super colliders. Let's take a question from the audience. Yeah. Right over there. Hi.
Hi. Thank you.
Hello.
You're so generous with your time. I know at the AMNH you have so many events that you put so much of your heart into, and your time, and you're so busy. Where now with new technologies, where do you get your information? How do you keep up with what's happening all over the world now?
Okay, that's a great question. First, I have access to a cloning machine. So all the times you see me there, that's a holographic clone. It's very hard. But so a couple of things. If I want to know something that hit today, I just look at my Twitter stream. And I have enough followers there that they say, what do you think of this? And have you seen this clip? Many a time I've been introduced to a YouTube clip of some importance that may have had like 100 views on it. So I feel like this community of people who support what I do are also part of my eyes and ears, my sensory system out there. And that's for sort of come and go pop culture things. For more scientific discoveries. I have colleagues and their journals and things that would be more typical. And my wife, who reads the New York Times every day, she'll just send me links every time because I can't scan it and pick the stuff out, but she knows what I need and like. And my kids, they keep me plugged in to anything that anybody under 20 cares about, because that's a whole other, we know, that's a whole other thing going on there. So it's multiple sources, but thanks for that question.
Let's see, we have some good geeky questions coming in on the phone.
Bring them on.
Let's see if I can get Eric from Hackensack on the line here. Eric, we have you?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi there. And you're on with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Hey.
Yes, it's a great honor here. I have a science question. We know from Professor Hubble that the universe is expanding. The stars are moving away from each other at increasing speeds. We also know that anything that has mass will gain mass as it approaches the speed of light. So will there come a point in the future where these stars will gain so much mass that they'll be forced by the laws of physics to come back into a great big cosmic egg or something?
Yeah. So that's a great question. So in Einstein's relativity, the general theory and special relativity, there's an interesting distinction between something moving through the fabric of space and the fabric of space itself stretching. And so the Hubble expansion that we all know and love, that is the expanding universe discovered by Hubble back in 1929, that we've only ever measured the universe to be expanding, and it is also likely accelerating in that expansion for a mysterious reason, by the way. So if you say, well, what reason is that? It's mysterious. but when it's the fabric of the universe expanding, you're not going to get this increased mass phenomenon that goes on when you are moving through the fabric of space. And for this reason, for example, the entire universe can expand faster than the speed of light. So there are none of the traditional restrictions that we get moving through space apply to the expansion of space itself.
And it may be expanding even more than we have previously realized. Knowing you were coming on today, a friend of mine emailed me this article from the Huffington Post just from yesterday, headline, "The universe may hold 10 times more galaxies than we thought." And it says, for decades, astronomers had put the number at 100 billion to 200 billion, but new research using data from the Hubble Space Telescope and other observatories shows that number is about 10 times too low. I don't even know how to get my mind around the difference between 200 billion galaxies and 10 times that and the implications for us. But you know this?
Yeah, so actually, my master's thesis, I predicted there'd be 10 times as many galaxies out there in the universe. So I have to check on what where they're going with that. I've made a prediction, but what matters in the end are observations. It's fun that if there are more galaxies, this more is better, I think. But galaxies are made of stars. Stars may have planets and people, or at least one of them has people. So what would be weirder is not if we found more galaxies than we thought, but if we found a different kind of thing out there. So don't be so concerned or have existential angst learning that there are more galaxies than you previously thought. In the universe, generally, we find more of what we thought was there rather than less.
Here's one more clip from Star Talk, and this is of you and World Science Festival founder Brian Greene.
Physicist, yeah.
And hold on to your conceptual hats, folks, because this is about not knowing what reality we're in as virtual reality technology becomes really, really realistic.
If it's the case that one day we can have computers that can recreate a reality in bits and bytes that has such verisimilitude that they're inhabitants of those simulations that feel that it's real, if that's possible, and I think many of us agree that it might be.
Sure.
We're getting closer already. Just let's assume that's possible. It's so much easier to create a simulation than it is to create a real universe. I mean, how are you going to create a real universe?
Right.
So if you wait long enough, there are going to be many, many more simulated universes than there are real ones. So any sentient being, if they're rational, would think that the odds are that they're in one of those simulations because there's so many more of those compared to real ones.
Statistically, you're in the simulated one, not the real one.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, yeah. So get over it. No. Consider if you can simulate a world with such precision. He used a bigger syllable word there, verisimilitude, but with such precision and accuracy that you create beings that have entire neurological function, bordering on free will, then they will just think they're alive. And if they're alive and they have some kind of free will and they're advanced enough, they might create a simulation within themselves just to simulate their own universe. And then it'll be simulated universes all the way down. So if you throw a dart at all the universes that exist as a random choice, we could be simply in one of those. So we could be invented by some kid in his parents' basement, some alien kids. And this would completely give us why laws of physics are this way and not some other way. It's because some kid invented it. If you play a game, like if you play Mario, Mario jumps and... you know, can go off the cliff but then scurry back. The whole laws of physics that apply to the game. If I were in that game and curious, I would measure the laws of physics operating in that game. They'd be different from ours because somebody programmed it in. And if you jump off, you can scurry and not fall down and come back to a surface. That's that universe's laws of physics.
Would we all need goggles?
it depends. Yes. So yeah, anyone who's thought about that problem is pretty much in agreement with it. So yeah, you can choose to not want it to be true, but like I said, the universe is under no obligation to make sense to you.
Here's a good geeky question from a good geeky town, Linda in Princeton.
That's for sure a geeky town. Yes.
Linda, you there?
Hello, Brian.
Hi there. You're on WNYC with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Brian and Professor Tyson. Mm-hmm. A mathematician friend of mine, Professor, said years ago when we were talking about this time capsule that had apparently been sent somewhere with Beatles tunes and music and art and mm-hmm. literature, that the one sure way of establishing whether there was, quote, intelligent life somewhere else in the universe, if not here, would be indicating the existence of the concept of prime numbers. And if another being recognized that, it would indicate that their intelligence had advanced, you know, remarkably or sufficiently. Could you answer that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Prime numbers, if I remember my high school math, being those that are only divisible by themselves and by one, is that correct?
Evenly divisible by themselves. All numbers are divisible by all numbers, but they have to be evenly divisible.
Yeah, to hold numbers.
With no remainder at the end, yes. Then you'd have a prime number. Right. I say that because in the movie Little Man Tate, this genius, you know, elementary school kid, the teacher asks, is this number divisible? Which of these numbers is divisible by 3? And he said they all are. And right. The teacher meant evenly divisible, but she didn't say it. And so the kid was beyond the teacher's thinking.
Because the kid invented the teacher. You just demonstrated.
Exactly. So probably the caller is thinking about the Voyager record, which was an affixed bit of information and actually a record player that contained sounds of our species. Andrewian was the creative director of that, who co-wrote both Cosmoses, the first and with Carl Sagan, and the one that I had the privilege of hosting a couple of years ago. And so she's a very creative person and thinks deeply about culture and civilization and our future. And so they thought a lot about what information you'd put on there, but it had to be encoded in a way so that an alien would have some chance of knowing what you're giving them. You can't write it in English. They're not going to speak English or French or Esperanto, right? Or is that what it's called? Esperanto?
Esperanto.
Esperanto, thank you. So you have to be creative, and you'd have to ask, what language is universal? Truly universal, not just Earth-wide. We so abuse the word universe on Earth. Miss Universe. No, she's Miss Earth, okay? Just get that straight, okay? Just please. All right. So the universe, the language of the universe is mathematics because it applies everywhere that we see and the laws of physics that gird it. So if you want to communicate with aliens, you probably would want to do it in some mathematical way, and prime numbers would be evidence that they have not only figured out how to talk to the universe, because math is that language, but maybe we could find a way for us to talk with one another.
Well, guess what? We will have to leave it there for talking with one another for this time.
You left 15 minutes for us to talk about the whole universe?
This universe.
This.
We'll do a half hour next time, and we'll talk about a couple of others, too. Neil deGrasse Tyson, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History and host of the podcast and National Geographic Channel TV show Star Talk, which now has an accompanying book, and co-author with fellow astrophysicists Michael Strauss and J. Richard Gott of the new book, Welcome to the Universe, an astrophysical tour. And for more information about the show, you can visit natgotv.com, natgotv.com. Dr. Tyson, thanks again.
Thanks for having me, everybody.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, the artist Marina Abramović from her appearance in the green space, including her exercise in loud mindfulness, and she tells a joke. But first, it's time for the latest news, live from the WNYC newsroom. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone, and welcome back to our day after Thanksgiving leftovers casserole as we re-air some of our favorite recent interviews, including this one recorded with performance artist Marina Abramović in WNYC's performance studio, The Green Space, in front of a live studio audience last month. And okay, I have to say it, the artist is present. That was the now famous name of the 2010 Museum of Modern Art retrospective of performance artist Marina Abramović's work. That was the show that featured, for those of you who don't know, Marina being physically present to sit in silence across from any museum goer who wanted to engage in that way. And thousands did, as Marina's marathon of being present lasted 8 hours a day on many days. Many visitors were moved by the experience, some even cried, and that's probably her best-known work, but is far from the most extreme project that she's undertaken. We'll hear about some of those. And Marina Abramović is here in the green space to talk about her life and art and the at least double meaning of the artist being present, I think, because of her interest in Buddhism. The occasion is the publication of Marina Abramović's memoir called Walk Through Walls. Welcome back to WNYC and welcome to the green space.
Before we start, yes. The book is upside down. So the whole program...
What's on its side,
No, you have to put this way. Perfect. No, just leave it there.
That'll be like a...
But, you know, upside down is not good luck.
For those of you not able to see on the radio, I'm holding it up like Vanna White. Here's the book. Would you say The Artist is Present was a turning point in your work and maybe for contemporary performance art overall?
You know, I come from Europe, and in Europe we have... I done mostly all the major museums doing very extreme and very kind of controversial work, but never had this kind of focus and media, especially attention, like in artists' presence. This was a change. You know, Americans are strange human beings. You know what's happening in Brooklyn, but you don't know what's happening, let's say, in Paris, not always. And... you have to be always in front of you that you know that the artists exist. They're great artists in Europe, but we don't know about them. So when I came here in America, especially in Museum of Modern Art, with such a huge frequency of visitors, this really changed everything because people actually start understanding how transformative form of performance art can be. Because performance was always... You think about performance like a stand-up comedy, like you think about performance standing with a glass of wine in exhibition and nobody even, you know, notice how it looks like. But performance is serious business, so I really try to show that.
I know you're into mindfulness meditation, so was there a double meaning to the artist is present physically in the room and also attempting to be in the present in a Zen kind of way?
Why works artists is present right now in America more than any other place? Because it's such a troubled country. And artists is present is really very simple, incredibly the you know, kind of simple concept. I'm sitting opposite of you. I'm looking you straight in your eyes. You're a total stranger. I never saw you before. We never have any words spoken. And everything happened. People are living in the past or they're living in the future, but present always escapes us. And the present is the only reality we actually can think of, because any second something can happen and you're not here and all of us adrenoid, you know, fall from the planet to the planet and everything explode. So it's about being here and now. And that's one of the most difficult things to do.
Let me do the legal ID here so the FCC doesn't yank our license, which is that you're listening to WNYC FM HD in AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJO 89.3 Netcong, and WNJY Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We're in New York and New Jersey Public Radio, and we're going to do a mindfulness exercise that you prepared for us in a few minutes. But let's talk a little bit more about your life and work first. The MoMA show was seen as an endurance exercise that sounds even torturous to do it for that long. But you've made art in ways that are much bloodier and much riskier. And I see that in one performance, you and your former partner in life and art, Ule, suspend a bow and arrow between you with the arrow pointed toward your chest. Marina William Tell Abramovich, why put yourself at the tip of the spear in that way?
You know, this, first of all, Ule was my partner and was a big love of my life. And we are both Sagittarius and we are both born in the same day, which is kind of, you know, incredible. And we made this performance on our birthday. And the idea was that he held the bow against my heart. And we have just two small little microphones, you know, that you can hear the sound of the heart beating, how adrenaline is rushing up. And this was the shortest performance we ever made because everything is much longer. But this was 4 minutes and 26 seconds. It was like a lifetime. And you know, it's total trust. How much you can trust somebody that can kill you if you lose the balance.
Why didn't you do the second 2 minutes and 13 seconds with you holding the bow at him?
You know, he'd been asked the same question, and he had this absolutely amazing answer. He said, you know, her heart is my heart, too. I'm not so sure anymore.
And your friends, I see, halted another work and took you to the emergency room. Can you share the circumstances of that?
Okay, it happens, you know, it's not all... But you know, I really try. First of all, we have to talk a little bit about what performance is. Performance is mental and physical construction that you put in the front of audience in exact time and space. And then anything would happen become performance. And you create energy dialogue with the public. So if earthquake comes or electricity fall down or something happen, is a part of it. I didn't plan that I had this 5-point star built from the wooden the debris and the sock in 100 liters of petrol. And I wanted to exorcise the star because it's a communist symbol which I come from, which I found in my books of school, and I found it on my birthday certificate and so on. So I made this a kind of ritual that I cut all my hair. I never done again, but that was the time. I cut all my hair. I was burning the star. I cut my nails. I cut two nails. And then finally, I lie in the star. And when I lie in the star, I wanted to lie there till all everything fall, you know, all the star burn and just see the shadow of my body. But oxygen, I didn't know that actually when you lie in burning star, that oxygen is gone and I lost consciousness. So when the little pieces of firewood fall on my legs and I didn't react, there was a doctor too happily in the audience who understand that actually I don't have consciousness and took me out.
And one more, and this is not to be sensational because I want you to get to a large point of what you're trying to do with art, with all of this type of work. We have an image that people in the green space will be able to see from your 1997 work, Balkan Baroque. Very disturbing image, and I wonder for listeners on the radio, can you describe this piece that won the Golden Lion at the Venice Biennial that year?
This piece was especially important for me because there was time was the Balkan War in ex-Yugoslavia, and you know, I've been asked so many times to react on this, and this is, I was ashamed of this war, and it was too close to me, and took me a long time till I was really invited for Venice Biennale to create this piece. And what I did, I have 2,500 of bones, cow bones, really big legs, with the meat on, and I tried to clean them. And I tried to clean them for days, you know, for, I don't know, 5 days, 6 hours a day. And you know, one thing you can never clean is blood. You can never actually clean shame of the wall. And this was almost Sisyphus, a metaphorical process. You know, every day I will come there in unconditional space where the worms would come out of the bones and then they would go all over me. Smell was devastating. It came into my skin and pores. And that piece was, you know, I wanted to create the image who is not just about the war in ex-Yugoslavia, but after war is finished, as now is not there anymore war, is always war somewhere else. Now we're in Syria, we are somewhere in the world. So that image, I want to try the key how I can create one image who can be used anytime, anywhere, where there is a problem.
So really a lot of your work is about finding interesting representations. Or representation is the wrong word. Interesting things for you to do for other people to see or engage with that express your most important feelings about the world, your horror about the war and what you just described, your feeling of love for your partner with the bow and arrow, engaging with strangers in the artist is present?
You know, my work the center of my work is the body, because we don't know much about our body. We know much about technology, but not our bodies at all. You know, it's much easier to learn to telepathy. It takes you 4 years, but you're using the telephone, which is more expensive. But because we don't feel any more intuition, we don't understand, you know, what's going on in our us. So I really like to create, I want to kind of stage things that in dangerous things and things that are disturbing, and to push mental and physical limits of the body to the point on the stage that the public can see, if I can do, you can do for yourself. You can actually go out of ordinary life, and you can, you know, break your habits, and you can, you know, change your consciousness. This is my really idea of my work, is if we're doing always the same things over and over again, you never change. You're just doing the same mistakes over and over again. But if you do things you don't know, the things you're afraid, that's the big possibility of change. My work is about to show you that kind of changes.
One of your major projects now that we should mention is developing an art center in Hudson, New York, up the thruway toward Albany, and sharing the Marina Abramovich method of developing mindfulness which shares a lot with Buddhist practice. I see you helped Lady Gaga quit smoking with your method. Can you give us a quick overview and then set up a beginner's lesson?
You know, it's 50 years of career, and the next month, on the 13th November, I'm going to be 70, which is serious age. So looking in the back, I could really see, you know, I went through so many good and difficult things in my life. It was not been easy. But I learned certain things that helped me in pushing my mental and physical limits and to really understand myself and you know, people around me and the world around me. So that exercise became Abramovich method. And they're very simple. I really create ones for the public that they can come to that kind of you know, space, or what I call here and now. The one exercise will be just counting the rice. Everybody at home have the rice. Sit down and count the rice. Looks easy. But if you take just handful of rice, you will find out that this will take something like 3 to 5 to 6 hours to count. And if you commit yourself, this is like life. If you can't count the rice, you can't do the life too. Because if you make the commitment, do it to the end. And during the process of counting rice, what you see, in the beginning, you're amused, okay, I'm counting the rice. After 20 minutes, 40 minutes, you're frustrated. Then you go, what am I doing? I'm crazy, I have to do something else. Then you really get angry. And when you pass all these states, you come to this feeling of calmness when the breathing is become really quiet. And then you really arrive to presence. It's lots of work to come to the presence. So to release this energy, it's very important. So my exercise today is very simple to you. I'm going to explain to you what we're going to do. And of course, we have a limit of time, and it's not long durational. But a part of that, if you go to anywhere to the nature, the one simple thing everybody can do, pick up one tree, hold the tree, and complain to the tree a minimum 15 minutes. Absolutely works. And more. Okay.
Did you say complain to the tree?
Complain, really complain. Open your heart. Do all thing, you know. So
about the tree? Like, why don't you take care of your bark better or something?
No, complain to live tree about all your you know. Complain to the tree. Okay. So, what I want to say. where we are. So now, for today, what I was thinking. I was thinking what I will ask you. I'd explain you first, and we're going to do it. You have to close your eyes. You should not cross your legs because it's absolutely wrong for you because cut your circulation of the blood. Sit straight. Put your hands on your knees, which is very comfortable. When you're going to close the eyes, I'm going to just do the breathing three times, but really slowly. I'm going to guide you through this. And then just kind of imagine that you're in present and take all energy of your body, but every single molecule, come into this huge primordial scream. We have so much to scream about situation in the world, about warming, about political situation, about everything that's going on, about ourselves, our own life, about own, you know, securities, insecurities. So that scream release that negativity and create this quiet space in you. So now you're going to do two.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Close your eyes. Put your sheet paper down. Not cross the legs. Fine. We close the eyes and just listen to my voice. Okay? Breathe in deep to the stomach, slow. Breathe out. Two. Breathe in slow to the stomach. Breathe out. Three. Breathe in to the stomach, breathe out. Now, all together, we're going to scream like nobody ever screamed before. Start now. What's happened to you?
That was great. How'd that feel, everybody?
Much longer, much harder, and don't be self-conscious for the next time.
And I didn't do it only because I'm sitting in front of the microphone, so it would have been really mean to the listeners on the radio. So,
how you feel?
Relaxed, a little relieved.
You see, that's the point.
And so what are you going to do in Hudson? You're going to have people to your place, like, workshops, like you're an artist and also sort of, you know, running a little Omega up there or that kind of thing?
No, we're creating the when we build the huts, we're still raising the money for this project. Basically, you have to sign the contract as a normal public to come in. When you come in, you have the contract to sign that you're going to stay 6 hours and give me the word of honor. If you leave before 6 hours is not my problem, is yours, because the word of honor is such an old thing that we forgot about. And in these 6 hours, you're going to be prepared to actually can see something with a long durational work of art, because public you just come from the street, you come with all your, you know, your history. You need to kind of rebalance yourself that you see something else which is long durational. The whole center is about long-durational performance art, but also about immaterial forms of art, which is theater, the dance, the music. Music for me is the highest form of art anyway, then performance, then video, then the what else we have got, the film, all the long-durational works. So then it will be something very long-durational that you could have this space, time, and patience to see. And working with lots of young artists, working with technology, working with all the science, you know, inventions and stuff like that.
Sounds great. Now, we've just got 2 minutes left, and now that we've been through all the serious stuff, I want to note that you also tell jokes in this memoir.
Lots of jokes. I love jokes. You know, I'm so serious in my work, but I'm completely hilarious in life.
Will you tell one?
Okay, I'll tell you one from the beginning of the book, so you're going to get the book. You have to read this book. It's really inspirational. For me, it was so important to make this book because it was like, you know, looking my life, but looking my life with a different perspective, without anger, really looking at all what happened in the right perspective when you get my age. So this is the, you know, the book, this is the joke from communist time. In Tito time where I was born, when you are best worker of the year, you get the watch. And that, you know, you go to pension, you get this really ugly Russian watch, which is really heavy, but, you know, it's with engrave your name and so on. But this guy was better than anybody else. He was like the best ever. So the government made this decision the first time ever, instead of watch, to give him a car. So he's overwhelmed with joy. People are really happy. Everybody applauded. And they say, we are ordering the car today. He's going to pension. And the car is going to arrive in 20 years. So the guy, you know, this is not America. So the guy say very seriously, I really want to know, is going to be in the morning or in the evening? I say, but what the hell you care for? Yes, because of my appointment with the plumber.
Nothing like a Soviet era joke.
Long durational jokes.
Please thank the artist Marina Abramović for an air on WMRC. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. WNYC, and Bruce Springsteen published a memoir last month, as many of you know. It's called Born to Run, and it's incisive, thoughtful, funny, and brimming with stories that give a satisfying peek into how the boss has crafted his narratives of broken heroes chasing that runaway American dream. And while we've been knee-deep in election politics, the book got us thinking about how the themes in Springsteen's songs keep on cropping up in American politics and society. Many of you had fun with our Bruce the Debate hashtag this week, so we thought we'd take a little time now to talk about the actual book and the artist and dig into a few songs that still resonate so much, whether they were written 4 or 40 years ago. So here with me now to follow a couple of those threads is David Camp, a Vanity Fair contributing editor who recently profiled Springsteen for the magazine. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be with you.
And let's listen to some music and talk about some of these ideas after hearing more specific examples. Here's about 45 seconds of the song The Promised Land, which came out on the record Darkness on the Edge of Town back in 1978.
I've done my best to live the right way.
In a promised land. What's going on with this man in the promised land? It referenced the promised land referenced in the song gives it a hopeful sheen. What do you think Springsteen is referring to there? And should this guy be hopeful?
I think it's despair mixed with hope, because he's talking about, you know, in the earlier part of the song, he's working at his daddy's garage. But then he says he wants to, in the part we just heard, he wants to explode and tear this town apart, take a knife and cut this pain from my heart. It's a really prevalent theme, especially of kind of the 70s and early 80s Springsteen, is restlessness. There's got to be something somewhere better for me, but it's not despairing. There's always a tincture of hope, though Springsteen would never use a word like tincture. But I mean, there's always a sense of a better life somewhere. I just got to get out of here.
Mm-hmm. So here's another one from that era, and tell me if you think this is thematically similar or different. This is the title track from The River.
I got a job working construction for the Johnstown Company, but lately there vanished right into the air. Now I just act like I don't remember. Mary acts like she don't care.
So that was 1980, Springsteen. The Johnstown Company that he mentions refers, I think, to a real-life company in a town in western Pennsylvania, steel country, or one that's emblematic of real ones there. And this, you know, Donald Trump actually held a rally in Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
So that speaks a lot to how things have perhaps evolved from 1980, when the song came out, to now, that you might have had a character like the protagonist in The River. He might have been one of those guys with a union job who faithfully voted up and down the Democratic Party ticket, because that's what union guys did in those days. And, you know, since Bruce Springsteen characters are fictional characters, we're allowed to extrapolate about what becomes of them. It's conceivable, Brian, that this guy might have gone from union straight Democratic ticket guy to Reagan Democrat to Republican to Tea Party to Trump. It's, you know, possible.
That song, by the way, I understand was written for his sister and brother-in-law, whose lives started out like the narrator in the song. What was their story?
Right. So there's a conflation of that Johnstown, Pennsylvania steel mill worker or construction worker. The actual circumstances of Bruce Springsteen's sister Virginia's life, when she was a senior in high school, age 17, she got pregnant by, in her senior year of high school, a fellow named Mickey Shave. And suddenly, as they say in the song, The River, that was all she wrote. They had a shotgun marriage. Mickey took on jobs in construction. She took a job in South Jersey working for Kmart. And they were a working-class, struggling couple. And this is before Bruce Springsteen is struck it rich, so he couldn't featherbed their existence with his residual wealth.
And we learn in the book, if we didn't know it already, that his dad was a gruff, detached guy who struggled with mental illness. Is it the specter of his father who hangs over a lot of his songs and his characters?
Absolutely, because the father embodied this restlessness that we've talked about. His father was a man who was a brooder, who drank six packs of beer in the dark in his kitchen, and his relationship with Bruce was very volatile. And ultimately, it kind of did explode into this flight west to California. When Ginny, the younger sister, was pregnant, and when Bruce was only 19, Dad just said, forget this. We're moving to California and leaving you kids behind.
And those are some of the roots that give Springsteen his working class bona fides to fuel his songwriting.
Right. And I mean, forget about that experience. Just the first 10 years of his life, even though they took place in the 1950s, were almost more Dust Bowl John Steinbeck than Ozzy and Harriet. You know, he was real privation, real that living in a ramshackle house with three generations, with his grandparents there. He had a tough, true to his persona, working class, bordering on poor upbringing.
One kind of funny side note, I learned from the book that Springsteen has never really held any kind of job other than playing music. Is that kind of ironic, considering he writes so much and so well about the working person?
You might say it, but if you think of how he approached rock music, he actually says in the book something along the lines of, I put on a factory worker's clothes. I put on my father's clothes to go to work. The only way he saw out of this, you know, post-industrial despair of Freehold, New Jersey, was music. And he went about it in a very workmanlike way.
As we talk about some of the themes in Bruce Springsteen's new memoir, Born to Run, and listen to a little relevant music with David Camp, Vanity Fair contributing editor, who recently profiled Springsteen for the magazine. We're going to move from the late 70s, early 80s to a more contemporary song. Here's a bit of the song Death to My Hometown from Springsteen's 2012 album, Wrecking Ball.
Send the robber bound straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around ate the flesh of everything they found. His crimes have gone unpunished now. Who walk the streets as free men now?
You could imagine a crowd singing there with their fist in the air like an anthem, except it's such a dreary message. Death to our hometown, boys. It should have been a football rah-rah with that kind of musical setting, I thought. But then when you listen to the rest of the lyrics in that verse, the greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Is this sort of Springsteen's Occupy song?
Yeah, this is his Occupy Wall Street anthem. Bear in mind, it came out in 2012. I think it was written a couple years earlier when we were still very much in the post-2008 recession. And we know Bruce Springsteen's politics to tack left. So we know that this would almost be a more of a Bernie song than a Trump song. But that said, if you look at the lyrics, they're about holding bankers and hedge fund guys accountable for looting the factories and destroying the way of life of the working and middle class people in this putatively New Jersey town, the hometown. And so he's not chanting death to my hometown. He's saying these guys caused the death, and now it's time for vengeance. And Brian, what's interesting about this song in 2012 is that you no longer have that hope that even his despairing 70s and early 80s protagonists have.
Wow. And Springsteen came out with a stinging rebuke of Donald Trump, even though in a way they seem to speak to the same core constituency. How do you see the overlap between Springsteen and Trump, touching some of the same hearts and minds as personal to the listener, despite coming to very different worldviews?
Well, they both have a talent for rousing huge, mostly white crowds. But the crucial difference is he has sympathy for the people in those crowds. He's saying these people are being conned. And he's saying these people have a reason to feel disenfranchised by globalization and the obsolescence of factory jobs. But that fellow is a con man. He's not the one who's going to lead them to the promised land.
If you're in your profile of Springsteen for this month's Vanity Fair, you talked about the actual song Born to Run, which is arguably his most famous song, and he named the book after it. It's climax of every single concert he plays, or so I'm told, that the two that I've seen it was, and he told you that he never really gets sick of it. Now, he was on Fresh Air earlier this month, and in this 15-second clip, he explains to Terry Gross how some of his older songs hold up.
So it was going back to my earliest music and re-singing my earliest songs that I wrote when I was 22. And it was funny that they just fit perfectly well. You know, there was they sort of gather the years up as time passes.
I love that phrase he uses, the songs gather the years up. What do you think he means by that exactly?
Well, he means that the themes resonate no matter what the era. And he said a good song. And one interesting thing about Bruce Springsteen is he's unprepossessing, but he's not immodest. Very conscious of, I have made an important contribution to American culture. And that was by design, too. That's, again, to go back to your question about, did he ever do an honest day's work? His workmanlike approach was to build up a great canon of songs. And Born to Run was consciously conceived when he was still a young fellow to be an important, durable song.
Here's one more clip of Springsteen from that Fresh Air interview talking about why he still lives pretty close to where he grew up in central New Jersey.
I just felt very comfortable here, and I was uncomfortable with city life. I was more or less a kid that came out of a small town, and I was a beach bum and loved the ocean and loved the sun, and I liked the people that were here. I liked who I was when I was here. I wanted to continue writing about the things that I felt were important, and those things were pretty much here. I felt like a lot of my heroes from the past lost themselves in different ways once they had a certain amount of success. And I was nervous about that, and I wanted to remain grounded. And living in this part of New Jersey was something that was essential to who I was and continues to this day to be that way.
Continues to this day to be that way. Do you think that's part of what keeps him so relevant musically and culturally?
Absolutely. He never became part of an L.A. or New York or a coastal elite scene, even though he, you know, owns a house in L.A. He never became part of a scene. He stayed in New Jersey. Brian, I actually wanted to share with you a quote that didn't make my Vanity Fair piece where we discussed this and how he said he never was fully part of the counterculture. He said, my band is pre and post hippie in a funny sort of way. There's a counterculture element that just came from growing up at that time. But I think there was also a suspiciousness of it because we came out of a small town where a lot of people went a different way. Like I was saying in the book, my brother-in-law, and this brings us, Brian, back to the river, my brother-in-law is a man of the 50s, and he'd lived his life like that. I have a foot in there myself. That's Bruce talking. So he's saying, like, I never turned on and tuned in, all that stuff. I retain a suspicion of the coastal elites myself.
This memoir is more than 500 pages long. Does it hold up as a book?
It's wonderful. And, you know, I was not mandated to come to that conclusion because I was profiling him. It's very easy to read. It's very episodic, short chapters. I asked him if he'd read Bob Dylan's Chronicles, which is much more elliptical and episodic. And he said, yeah, and I really love that book, but there was no way I could do a book like that. I just, same thing, put on my factory man's clothes, put my head down, and write it chronologically.
And we leave it there with Vanity Fair contributing editor David Camp. Thanks so much for coming on the show and talking about Bruce Springsteen's memoir, Born to Run.
Thank you, and thanks for Bruce the Debate. Loved it.
Make an honest stand, but they wind up wounded, not even dead. Tonight in jungle land.
It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and if you walked your dog this morning, I'll bet you played at least one game of tug of war. The dog wanted to stop and smell something, and you wanted to keep going. Well, my next guest reminds us that for a dog, that sniff on the sidewalk is loaded with information that we can't even begin to perceive. Alexandra Horowitz teaches at Barnard College, where she runs the Dog Cognition Lab, and she's the author now of Being a Dog, Following the Dog into a World of Smell, which explains how dogs perceive the world through their most spectacular organ, the nose, and how we humans can put our underused sense of smell to work in surprising ways. Alexandra, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much.
So dogs have been used to hunt and track people for generations. We know that. But some of these new things you write about are incredible. Like dogs are being used to detect cancer.
Exactly. Yeah, they're being trained. This is pure research, basically, to detect the volatile elements that indicate that there's cancer. They can do it on breath, in blood, in urine. There's good evidence that they're going to be able to do it on people.
Meaning early detection?
Hopefully. I mean, it's certainly earlier than we have instruments that can detect.
And you write that dogs can smell earthquakes before they happen. How does that work?
Well, there's some indication, still anecdotal, that they're smelling changes of smell that come with changes of weather. So, for instance, with a thunderstorm is an easier example. They might be noticing that there are smells from the earth that are lifted when there's low pressure right above the earth that indicates an oncoming storm. So they alert to that.
Could dogs alert people early enough to get people and other dogs out of harm's way of an earthquake?
Potentially, if they were trained to know to do that. So I think there's a lot in the dog's olfactory universe that they notice. But what working dogs do is they know to tell us when something happens. Most dogs haven't been so trained.
And dogs can detect counterfeit goods, you're right.
Absolutely. I mean, they can be trained on very small amounts of explosives. They can be trained to detect specific drugs, elements of electronics. I think the limits are our imagination, not really the dog's capacity.
Bootleg videos?
Sure. I mean, it could be, yeah, absolutely.
And explosives. When did dogs first get trained to smell out explosives?
Well, it's been happening for decades. It's only recently that it's ubiquitous, that you're going to see dogs in every airport and at every major event. And certainly dogs could detect that small amount of TNT or other explosive all along. It's just that they didn't know to tell us when they had.
So when we see police dogs at the airport or Penn Station, it's not that they're there to bite you if you're a criminal.
Well, I mean, some police dogs are trained in bite, right? But a lot of these dogs are detection dogs, and they're looking for illegally imported goods. They're looking for drugs. They're looking for explosives. They're looking for something unusual that shouldn't be there.
So here's a vocabulary word. Dogs' noses are stereoscopic, as opposed to our noses, which are monoscopic. Is that sure. like the same thing with music systems, mono and stereo?
Absolutely. It means basically dogs are getting a different odor picture in each nostril. So they're able to then recreate the smell of the world in 3D, the way we do with vision.
And what does that allow them to do, for example?
Well, so the way we open our eyes and see the world and can tell distance by our stereoscopic vision, they can smell how far away something is by the different odor sample from each nostril.
And you talk about the physical act of sniffing. How are the sniffing behaviors of dogs different than how humans sniff?
We have kind of a gross sniff. We just sniff in and out the same nostrils. But and we also take about a second and a half to do a sniff, which is pretty slow. So dogs can sniff about 5 to 10 times a second. That allows them to get many more odor pictures into their nostrils. And then people studying fluid dynamics have shown that they actually exhale out the side slits of their nose.
Huh.
So that allows them to have a continuous image of the smell world.
Is that what you mean when you're right that dogs have different sniffing tactics, different dogs do, on the air or on the ground, two of the ways that you mentioned?
That's actually something even separate. So they're sniffing things in the breeze. You'll notice sometimes a dog in a breeze with their nose in the wind, as it were. And then tracking dogs have their nose on the ground. That's smelling something that maybe some of us could smell. We don't put our nose that close to it in order to see what's been passed.
And they also exhale differently than humans.
Yeah, this out the side slits of their nose is an amazing anatomical design to allow the smell to not be rushed out of their nose. If we want to get a smell out of our nose, we exhale it out. But dogs don't want to get a smell out of their nose. You know, they want to continue to have an odor picture of the world. So the side slits of their nose is where they exhale.
Joan in Dix Hills, you're on WNYC with Alexandra Horowitz. Hi, Joan.
Hi, good morning. I have a cute story that I had this German shorthaired pointer, and she wasn't particularly that close to me, but for some reason, one day she just would not leave my side. I mean, she was like glued to me wherever my foot went. She followed right next to me, and I was a little nervous at what was she doing, and I went to the doctor to find out I was pregnant. So
wonderful.
I thought that was quite clever of her.
Yeah, that's a wonderful indication. Probably dogs are noticing changes in our physical state all the time, and we're not really noticing that they're noticing. So, you know, pregnancy will induce a different smell of you, and minimum in the hormones that you're producing, and dogs are able to detect. Disease smells. So the very first cases of cancer detection dogs were anecdotes where owners notice their dog, you know, being annoying, going at something on their leg. They go to the doctor and they find out they have a melanoma.
Marjorie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi, Brian. You know, for all the times I have called this show because I'm crazy about some political thing, it's amazing that this is the time I get through. So here's my question. Why does my dog, with such an amazing sense of smell, have to put his nose literally on top of other dogs' poop in order to smell it thoroughly?
You right. had to ask that question, didn't
it always,
you?
Poop is always going to come up with this topic.
But this is in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people ask that because they think, well, of course they can smell it at a distance, so why do they need to get so close? And I think we kind of mistake our nose for theirs here. It's not that they're trying to detect whether it's there at all. They're trying to get a full measure of the smell, to notice all its details and components. And to do that, you have to get closer to a smell, us as well as dogs. So that behavior is perfectly normal. They're just seeing it more closely.
And there is something about dogs getting up into the rears of other dogs.
Precisely, same thing. They want to get the, you know, all the information, identifying information they can about the other dog. I mean, every dog, like every person, has a signature scent. And dogs are interested in getting all of that information.
Now, for people, you can walk into a house with a strong odor, but after 5 minutes, you no longer smell it. I think that's why people will sometimes come into your own home and say, oh, what's that smell? Because you're not familiar anymore or you're not sensitive to the odor of your own stuff. But if you walk into somebody else's house, you smell it. Do dogs reach a point where they can no longer reliably follow a scent?
Well, that's a great question. The adaptation is what happens to us, which means you go in the coffee shop, it smells great. 5 minutes later in line, there's no smell.
Right.
That's a normal process of cells. So probably the dogs also get adapted, but they're also, but if you take a slightly different quantity or range of odor in your nose, then you'll get the scent again. In other words, they've adapted to that specific odor, but something changes, then you can smell it. So if dogs are always getting new bits of the odor sample, then they won't get adapted to the smell.
Lisa in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
My question is, do dogs, does their sense of smell diminish as they get older? I have two miniature dachshunds, and they're both 15 years old. And one, when I come home, she's all over me. She wants to smell everything that I came into contact with during the day. The other one, he doesn't seem to really care. And I could put a piece of meat on the floor behind him or next to him, and he doesn't see it. He doesn't seem to smell it.
Mm. It's certainly possible that sense of smell diminishes over time in dogs because of disease or simply deterioration of cells. There is one reason why dogs might persist in smelling a little longer than their sight or hearing, which is that olfactory cells, the cells that do the smelling, actually regenerate every 30 days in us as well as in dogs. So we get new cells all the time. So it's likelier it would continue, but sure, it could get worse. And probably one dog maybe needs a little more smell use in order to regrow those cells.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. What sorts of dogs are the best smellers? Does breed matter? Does snout size matter?
Well, absolutely. Dogs who have been bred to be scent hounds have more of their olfactory over the genome devoted to olfaction than other dogs. But all dogs, I should say, are phenomenally better, more well-endowed in these olfactory cells than we are. Long-nosed dogs, also, you know, retrievers, pointers, have more cells than short-nosed dogs. So on an untrained, when they're untrained, they're probably going to perform at slightly higher levels than a small-nosed dogs, which is why you don't see a lot of pugs doing explosive detection work in the airports.
Alexandra Horowitz, my guest on WNYC. She runs the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard and is now the author of Being a Dog, Following the Dog into a World of Smell. And Janet in Little Italy, you're on WNYC. Hello, Janet.
Hello. I have spent a lot of time on the Shongum Ridge in Ulster County, and when I would let my dogs out in the morning, they would just stand on the lawn and sniff the air, and I swear it was just like they were reading the morning paper. They knew who'd been in the neighborhood. They knew what was going on just by smelling those invisible ribbons, I think, of odor that were passing in the air.
Thank you, Janet. And I see there's no noxious scent receptor in the dog's brain. So does that mean for dogs there's no such thing as something that smells awful?
Behaviorally, it doesn't look like they find too many things repulsive. I mean, as any dog owner knows, the things that we find off-putting, dogs like to go right up to and take a good sniff of. So I think they sometimes avoid their own excreta, that unless they have some disease. But basic, and I also will suggest that they sometimes don't like odors that we think of as clean odors, which we use to cover their odor. For instance, you know, when a dog gets out of a bath, they usually don't stand there proudly admiring their smell, but go to roll in something, perhaps trying to get that odor off. But yeah, I think they view smells as information, not as good or bad as we do.
And lastly, I see from the book that you've been inspired by your dogs to become a better smeller yourself, and you've embarked on a smell tour of New York City. I feel like I spend a lot of time in New York trying not to smell too much. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I thought if I wanted to understand what it's like to be an olfactory creature, I had to follow my dogs. And so I first started smelling what they did, which is a little socially awkward. And then I've gone on smell walks with people who are trying to map the smellscape of New York City and other places. With a group, you know, you go up and start smelling things. It turns quickly from being a kind of awkward situation to really fascinating, this whole level of information that we usually are missing. When you intentionally go to smell it, it doesn't feel as off-putting. And it's actually a delightful additional component of my life now, even in New York.
Really fascinating stuff. Alexandra Horowitz, author of Being a Dog, Following the Dog into a World of Smell. She teaches at Barnard, where she runs the Dog Cognition Lab. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
in the street. Compete. Compete.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And will anyone be paying for your Black Friday purchases in cash? New technologies are making the convenience of living cash-free a reality. In fact, according to some research, almost half of us walk around with less than $20 in our pockets now. There are so many other ways to pay, a dozen and counting, including mobile wallets and store-branded payment apps, and of course, old-fashioned credit and debit cards. But what are the potential security and privacy trade-offs? I'm joined by Jeff Bliskull, senior editor at Consumer Reports, and the author of their recent article on the risks and rewards of going cashless. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Well, living in the city completely cashless is still almost impossible unless you want to spend a minimum of $5 every time you go into a bodega. So how close are we to no cash?
Actually, we are quite close because if you think about it, credit cards and debit cards are also cashless. A smaller, you know, a rising amount is these mobile wallets like Apple Pay and Android Pay. So they're still trying to gain ground because, as you mentioned, not everybody accepts those, and you do have some minimums there. But about 14% of the volume, only about 14% of the volume of our expenditures is in cash now. That's according to the latest data. So there's, you know, we're paying lots of other ways. And if you think, if you include online bill pay, people are doing that more, so you're not writing checks. You know, it's gaining traction. We're at a tipping point, according to the experts.
And Venmo is so popular, it's become a verb. People say, I'll Venmo you. Like, I'll Google
right.
that. It's so easy. But I guess one of the big questions you're raising is it really secure? So what are the security risks for a payment app like Venmo?
Well, certainly, you know, there are some security risks. Obviously, if it gets hacked, And cyber criminals are relentless, so that's always going to be a risk out there, and it can put you at risk. But with Venmo, if you're connected to generally, if you use a underlying credit card, and a lot of these cashless payment methods use an underlying credit card or debit card, you will have the same protections. So if you take mobile wallets, for example, Apple Pay, you load on a credit card. If something happens, somebody hacks in or somebody, you know, intercepts. Now, it's more difficult with the technology. It's actually better than a credit card, a plastic credit card, because there are built-in additional security features such as encryption and fingerprint. You know, your wallet will work unless you use your fingerprint to make it work. But if all that fails, you still have your consumer protections for credit cards. So if unauthorized charges, you're not going to pay for them.
Mm-hmm. You're right. One of the biggest privacy concerns is unanticipated uses of your data because privacy policies tend to give their authors broad permission for uses that may not even exist yet. What do you have in right. mind in particular?
Well, you know, so at the moment, the biggest threat, quote unquote, is that you will get targeted advertising. So if you're the stuff that you buy with your mobile wallet, they may include information about your Google searches and such. So what the idea of that is, oh, okay, you're looking around for stereo headsets, so you must be in the market for that. You know, you're searching for that. You must be in the market for that. And you went to a store and you bought something, you know, related to stereo headsets. And so you're going to start receiving ads for that. That's not really that huge a threat. The more troubling one or the concerning one may be down the line. And again, because these privacy, you know, you sign these privacy agreements, or you don't sign them, you agree to them by using the service, mm-hmm. and they're very open-ended. So, for example, you know, how will this affect your insurance rates? If it's suddenly found that you're out partying and gambling a lot, or you know, going to bars, have a lot of charges on bars and such, maybe that could lead to someone cobbling together and developing an algorithm that suddenly says, aha, this guy, you know, we'd better raise his insurance rates. So that's kind of the things where you don't expect. And then of course with everything exposed to you know, the government spying on us with the phone service. And I mean, ultimately, the government has access to all these records. So that's another concern out there. But again, at the moment, it's just marketing things. And people are kind of like, oh, that's pretty harmless. But it can be not harmless.
Let me take a caller, because I think Aaron in Pine Bush wants to amplify what you just said about the government. Aaron, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yeah, hi. You know, I work in an industry where tips and cash are wonderful and actually, you know, help me live day to day. And I just feel if we were to totally go cashless, you know, not only would Uncle Sam know every dealing that we know, and if anybody who works in the service industry, if we were to be completely honest, and if they know every single penny that we made, we really wouldn't be able to survive as a service.
You mean the best reason for continuing a cash economy is tax evasion?
Not necessarily, but it's also a way. I think I'm able to kind of pass a better price on to the customer if I have a cash, knowing that I'm uh-huh. not going to be killed with taxes myself. I mean, I just feel like it almost wouldn't work. I've worked in places, you know, whether you're doing construction, whether you're a hair salon, if you don't have cash and you're doing a service, unless you're selling a product and that's what you can do because that's where you can jack up your prices.
Right.
But if you're just a strictly service business, it's really hard to kind of do everything, I guess, like, you know, by the books, and whether you want to call it tax evasion or whatnot, or having Uncle Sam know every little thing possible so they can squeeze every little penny out of you, I don't always think that's, like, the best idea.
Right. Jeff, what about that? Yeah. And Aaron is suggesting a few things there. One is that the cashless economy is actually going to make things more expensive.
Yeah, well, I do think she's right, on the right track about just kind of the freedom, if you will, that we have. You know, I mean, if I got a speeding ticket for every time I went over the speed limit, you know, I'd probably have 100 speeding tickets, right? You know, because as you drive, sometimes you go, oh, it's 35, I'm going 40, whatever. You know, so what she's talking about there, I think, is it allows for this kind of perfect surveillance of you and, you know, every little thing, and there's no freedom and there's no cutting some slack here and there. So yeah, I think that is a concern, and there is a like an underground economy in the U.S. And one of the reasons people don't want to go, you know, one of the reasons people pay in cash is because they're doing something illegal or they're buying something that they don't want people to know about.
Right.
You know. So yeah, so this is something that has to be balanced, I guess, because people want their privacy and we want our freedom. You know, we don't want the government, you know, in our looking over our shoulder every single thing we do.
Aaron, thanks. Call us again. Zane in Maplewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Zane.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
A quick comment with the caveat that I've got a 3-year-old in the background, so I may have to take off any second.
Yep.
But I've been pleasantly surprised with using Samsung Pay. I don't believe your caller mentioned that on system. You can use it at any credit card swipe. It has some technology in it that broadcasts it. Your information right into any Magstrip and reader, and it's been great. I've been saved a bunch of times forgetting my wallet in the car or anything like that. I've been using it for probably over a year, and I've only encountered one machine ever that wouldn't take it. So that's about all I got. I'm going to take my comments.
Zane, thanks a lot.
I can give you more detail on that. We do mention Samsung Pay in there. Apple Pay and Android Pay work on something called near field communications technology, which is like a radio. There has to be a specific reader that can transmit and send these signals back and forth with the phone. Samsung Pay, so that about 3 million merchants in the U.S. have that technology now. So you could use your Apple Pay in about 3 million merchants, you know, physical stores. Samsung Pay has that technology, plus they have built into the phone a technology that allows the phone to communicate with the Magstripe. You know, when you swipe the card through the Magstripe reader. That's a little bit different technology. It has encryption and such, so it's secure. But it allows Samsung Pay to communicate with about, it's usable now at about 10 million retailers. So it's more widely available.
Stephanie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stephanie.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I may sound both old and old-fashioned with my questions and comments, but when I hear these things, I can't help but wonder about two things. One, what happens when, if and as the electrical grid goes down, as it did with September 11th and then the blackout, you know, 6-7 months mm-hmm. later? It was a hot mess. I was there. I lived in Brooklyn. That's one thing. The second thing is, on the heels of, you know, the discovery a year and a half later, whatever, that 500 million Yahoo email users got hacked, what if these systems get hacked? So when I look at, when I hear these things, I say, hey, wait a minute. Great. It's convenient when it's convenient. It's when it's working.
And then it's a disaster when these, and Stephanie, I'm going to cut you off only because we have a minute left in the show and I want Jeff to be able to answer your really good questions. Jeff, go ahead.
Yes. And I don't think cash is ever going to completely go away because of exactly that. Another problem is what happens when your phone runs out of electricity, right? Your battery dies. You can't use it. So I think people will always need to have cash. And she's exactly right. In terms of when there's a hurricane, the Federal Reserve gets a big jump in from the banks at ordering cash because people go to the ATM and they want to have cash on hand. So cash is a very comforting thing to have in your pocket.
Well, it looks like we're headed for a world in which the big debate will be whether Harriet Tubman or Andrew Jackson should appear on the Venmo homepage. We thank Jeff Bliskell, senior editor at Consumer Reports, author of the article Cashing Out, New Technologies Are Making the Convenience of Living Cash-Free a Reality. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed hearing some of our recent segments. We'll be back live on Monday. Enjoy your weekend, everybody. I'm Brian Lehrer.